This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. The late Nelson Mandela is the most prominent name linked to the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. But there were numerous leaders fighting in other ways to free black South Africans from racial segregation and oppression. Dr. Sadasivan Cooper, or Seth as he likes to be known, a clinical psychologist and president of the International Union of Psychological Sciences, was one such figure behind the scenes. He joins us today on the show to talk about some of his work in psychology and the reason why he's here in Kuala Lumpur. Dr. Cooper, welcome.
My pleasure.
So you were born in 1950, just 2 years after the National Party came into power in South Africa. And it's when official apartheid rule began. What was life like in Durham when you were growing up in the 50s and 60s, especially as part of the Indian community?
Well, life was totally segregated. You had to live in a residential area designated for your group. The schools, the shopping, the sports that you engaged in was all confined to that group alone. People worked in mixed contexts, but even the entrances into the workplace were segregated. Toilets were segregated. Restaurants in the city were reserved for whites, and maybe a few in the outskirts for black people. And those that were for blacks admitted everybody, whereas the white restaurants you couldn't get into. So the schooling was just for your race group alone. And
did it seem normal to you then?
No, it was very abnormal because in the neighborhood there were, and I grew up in a rural area, so in that area there were Zulu-speaking kids that we used to play soccer with, kick ball with, do everything with after school. And during the day, they went off to a school that was designated for them, and we went to the school that my father actually built because in that area there was no school. So it was odd, and I recall my father engaging with the the black African school for us to have joint sport meetings. So we'd do that once a term or so. And it became a routine, and the Department of Education came to hear about it and they put a stop to it. So what was being enjoyed by the kids, and everyone had a good time, a stop was put to. And around that time, I ended up going into the city. I grew up on the outskirts of Durban and then had to go to the city for my high schooling. And the same in the high school. It was restricted. But the high school was a boys-only school, and it had a lot of ferment because we objected to certain practices. We objected to hoisting the apartheid flag and national days that were designated for celebration in the school, we would boycott. So my political consciousness in that sense grew from that period. And as a child, when we went into the city, we would want to stop off on the near the beach and get something to eat or have an ice cream. But my father would not stop, and we thought he was a mean old man for not stopping. But he did not stop because there was no place that you could stop, no place that you could get an ice cream, and you couldn't swim in those beaches because they were all segregated. So you learned that a little later in life. So when I went to college, it was a college designated for people of Indian origin. And in a few years ahead of me that there was going to be the university was going to become autonomous. It was going to give its own degrees and so on. And I began a protest against that and mobilized the students to oppose that institution because, you know, it was one thing being in a college where you got a degree at a national level from the University of South Africa. But now you're going to get it from an Indian university with an ethnic tag. And so I protested that and I got expelled in my second year. But in that period, I was also involved in cultural activity. And that's where I met Steve Biko because he was a student in medical school. And we did the same kinds of student activism, he on his campus and me on my campus. And I was invited to the founding of the South African Students Organization. But I'd just been expelled. So I refused to go to the opening because I said the state will publicize the fact that the people who attended, the students who attended, some of them are not students anymore. And I didn't want to be spoiling the launch by my presence in that meeting. But Steve insisted. He said, you must come. I, on principle, did not go because I did not want the founding of the organization to be spoilt by the government publicizing that there were non-students present and so on. And that student organization actually created the consciousness that resulted in more and more young people in particular opposing apartheid. Because at that time, the late 60s, early 70s, there was no political activity. People were required to participate in ethnic structures, ethnic local councils, where the white council took the decision and sometimes tolerated another council's resolution. The parliament was white, and whites constituted just about 10% of the population. Officially at the time, the figures given were 12 to 14%. Now whites constitute just 8%, and these are accurate statistics. So in a sense, the lie that was apartheid included them bloating their own statistics. But they arrogated unto themselves all power, all privilege, the land, and business. And indeed, currently, business is still in white hands. So at least 90% of the stock exchange is controlled by white interests. And the kinds of policies that Malaysia has had of enabling local participation has not really taken root in South Africa. There were a few people who came on board, who were brought on board, people I've known, students, including the current deputy president of the country, who've become quite rich. But that wealth has not gone down to any sizable extent to create a very strong, say, middle class. So the poverty gap, the income inequity is massive. It's one of the most unequal societies on earth. And yet we're a very wealthy country. We're resource rich and we have various things going for us, including the wonderful tourism. You've got mountains, you've got sea, you've got ocean, you've got rivers, you've got wildlife. We border two major oceans, the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. But somehow, blacks are politically in charge, but not economically. And socially, even, the segregation is there. People still foregather in places that they choose to go to as traditionally white places or as traditionally black African and so on. And that's part of the maturation that needs to happen, where people begin to look at themselves as South African first rather than as any ethnic group or any religious belief that they may be part of.
I'm speaking today to Professor Seth Cooper, who is a clinical psychologist and president of the International Union of Psychological Science. We'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. My name is Chua Antik. With me today is my guest, Professor Seth Cooper, clinical psychologist and president of the International Union of Psychological Science. He's here in Kuala Lumpur to give a talk on the future of psychology in a globalized world, of which we'll talk about in a short while. Professor, before you went into the break, you said a lot of your awakening or political consciousness came about when you entered high school, when your fellow students were verbalizing or articulating a lot of the injustices that permeates their surroundings. When you were growing up, before that period, how did your parents explain what's happening around you, and were you already ready to receive the kinds of political message and talks and speeches that was going on in your high school years?
Well, my mother would she was more politically active in a sense in her youth, and would regale us with stories of, you know, attending meetings of major figures in the 40s and early part of the 50s. So I came to know some of those names through her. And a lot of the kinds of things that the protests that took place, my parents did not fully support, because they were worried what would happen. But at the same time, they did not take any active steps to intercede. So they would not intercede and say, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't participate in that, you shouldn't organize certain kinds of activities, because that's the role that I and my fellow students played. We were key in organizing these activities. But they would point out the consequences, say, you know, that there was likely to be consequences, the police is going to pay more attention and look at what's happened to other people. People have ended up in jail. People have ended up being banned. People have left the country, and so on. And we took note of it. But at the same time, I think there was a propulsion to do something about the situation and not to be immobile, not to be limited by the fact that there was something wrong with the picture that constantly presented itself to us. There was something wrong in engaging in that very narrow, segregated way with people in school, in the formal sports field, and yet we engaged at other levels. So, in a sense, there was a quest to look at changing what was going on. And so in my university years, we actually mobilized ourselves, mobilized other students, mobilized adults, mobilized our parents, and created the biggest internal opposition to apartheid, which effectively ended up with June 16th, 1976, erupting. You know, the events where kids in Soweto and other parts of the country decided that they were not going to tolerate Afrikaans, the language of oppression, being imposed as a medium of instruction. And in that period, I was also on trial. So I and my colleagues were on trial. And basically it was being charged for our ideas. There was no physical activity that outside of meetings and rallies. So our ideas were on trial. There weren't physical acts of sabotage or violence that we committed. And my group, when we were convicted at the end of 1976, we were all university students in our early 20s to mid-20s. And we ended up in prison being university students, the only group that arrived in prison being university students and leaving prison being university students. And in that time, we were also prevented from studying. Even Mandela was allowed to study. And in order to punish us, they refused us study privileges until the last 2 years of my imprisonment, when I decided I was going to pursue psychology. Because until then, I was doing law. And I decided I was not going to pursue law and pay allegiance to an apartheid state, because it would not stand well with my conscience. I was not going to stand up and say, I swear to uphold these laws, which I found illegitimate and oppressive. So that's why I ended up in psychology.
On that point, not the entire white South African population believe in segregation. And I was wondering, did you ever come across anyone, any native South Africans who are in favor or support the regime of the apartheid regime?
Well, look, the majority of whites benefited from that system. And make no mistake, a significant percentage of African and Indian as well supported the state. They became policemen and women. They participated in segregated structures. But the majority did not. So there were majorities amongst the black population that did not support apartheid. There was a very small minority amongst whites who also stood with us in student struggles and other activities. So they would participate and we would engage with them on those issues. But our challenge to them was, you should actually mobilize your parents not to continue the oppression. You should mobilize your MPs to stop the segregation and to stop being as oppressive. And after Hitler Germany, South African apartheid was the most oppressive system that the world has known. So some students, white students, took that to heart and decided to follow through. And they actually found it very difficult, because at a dinner table, when you say to your father, you are oppressing the people who work for you, you are oppressing my friends and their families, it doesn't sit well. So that was a major disjuncture, if you like. And so our approach was, we will continue mobilizing our communities and create an awareness. And that's exactly what we did. We did not let up in terms of, even whenever we were arrested. I was banned for 5 years. And to be banned when you're 22 years old, restricted to your apartment from 6 p.m. in the evening to 6 a.m. every day, from 2 p.m. on a Saturday to 6 a.m. on a Monday, is not easy. You could not be in a gathering at any time of more than one other person. You could only speak to one person. You could have maybe a meal with one person. But the moment there were three of you, that was regarded as a gathering, as a crowd. And I could not enter an educational institution. I could not do certain kinds of work. And by the way, that was despite there being job reservation, because outside of medicine and law and teaching and nursing, all the other professions were in white hands. So you could not become an engineer. You could not become an architect. You could not, if you wanted to be a physicist, you could only teach. You could not do other things. So all of that has now ended And so we should have a better, hopeful future. But I think we are confronted with leadership that has allowed itself to be corrupted, people who have done for themselves rather than doing for the majority of people. And when it comes to election time, and I think this is true the world over, they will make promises about doing things for the people, but really doing it for themselves and not caring much about the future and not caring particularly about young people who are the bulk of many of our societies. In the majority of the world, youth are the major population, and they are totally discounted, whereas older people make those decisions, and largely those decisions get made for themselves.
How does the regime enforce a rule like that, not allowing you to see more than one person at a time? Are there just a lot of policemen on the streets?
Well, there were a lot of spies. But they would come in at odd hours and check on you, and they would follow you around. It was a police state. You know, you could not enter certain places. You, if you did not have a permit in, you could not go into a certain university. It's that kind of thing. So it was fairly easy to police. But I think the biggest policing was self-policing. So I'm the eldest of three boys, and it was my mother, and we had a cousin living with us. So we'd have dinner, and I said that, you know, it cannot mean that having dinner is a gathering. So we would have dinner, and the police would come, and they would see us together, and they would not do anything about it because, you know, there was a certain Christian ethic, if you like, about apartheid. And, you know, the family was put out. And backward regimes all over the world actually put that forward, the family. Meanwhile, they do everything to disrupt a family. So they saw it, and they did not prosecute. But if I was with anybody else, including my lawyer, my lawyer had come to visit me, and when they came in, they saw him in the apartment, and they left, and they waited downstairs for him, and they interrogated him downstairs. So this guy was scared as hell. He was a politico himself, you know, much older than I was, but he was scared because we, in a sense, because of our open opposition to the apartheid system, attracted their attention, and therefore to be seen with us in those kinds of limited contexts would attract attention to them as well. But I think that fear that existed in the period where apartheid oppression was at its height, and our opposing it and saying, you can do what you want, but we will pursue this quest not to be oppressed by you. We'll pursue the quest for freedom, actually ended up creating an awareness from a lot of people, because people began to actually participate. And so even when I was on trial, we would be raced down from the prison in Pretoria to the High Court, which was about 4 to 5 kilometers away. And there would be pillion riders. We'd have blue light cars, you know, escorting us and so on. And we would sing protest songs and freedom songs. And so people would wait for us each morning and each afternoon when we got back from court. The streets would be lined. And it was a slow thing that grew. But sometimes we knew the intersection of a certain street that so-and-so would be waiting there. We knew the guys who would be waiting there. So that created an awareness. And it also instilled a sense of fearlessness in more people because they saw us, even in those conditions of oppression, and deciding that we're not going to be cowed by police might.
You paid a very high price, personal price, for your political beliefs. You mentioned you got expelled from the university and you spent 9 years in jail, five of which was with the late President Mandela. Because you were so young then, were you ready to spend, for the possibility of spending, you know, the rest of your lives behind bars?
Well, you know, we knew what we were doing. It wasn't as if somebody mobilized us. We were mobilizing other people. So we expected that there would be a comeback. In the form it happened was quite sudden. But even when we were on trial, we actually decided we will not have defense. So we fired our lawyers and said we were going to defend ourselves until eventually one of our attorneys said, you know, we need to defend you. You will run the case, but we need to present the case. And we believe that your case is winnable. And we said, but they're going to lock us up. We're already locked up. We've been denied bail. And they're going to put us away for a long time. And the lawyer said, well, this is why we need to present a case, so that when they do lock you up, you have put your case to the country and the world. And that's exactly what we did. So Steve Biko's major testimony was as our chief defense witness. So in the movie that Richard Attenborough made of Cry Freedom, with Denzel Washington playing Biko, he was the witness in the trial that I was accused number one in. And we planned it that Steve would be able to articulate our views, because each of us had charges, individual charges that we needed to account for, but that Steve would present the ideological position unfettered, and that's exactly what he did. So we knew why we were there, and when we got to the different prisons, including Robben Island, we did not allow the warders to get away with any further diminution of our human rights. You know, we insisted on the modicum of rights that the prison allowed and would hold them to account on. So we'd say, you did not give us this, which we're entitled to. And why are you locking us up at this time when we're entitled to exercise twice a day for half an hour at a stretch? So even though we were in solitary confinement for a significant part of the imprisonment, we'd insist on those rights. And that, I think, was our attitude to imprisonment and being convicted. So we did not regret that. So even when we got to Robben Island, we said, well, we knew why we were imprisoned, so now this is a new experience, so let's make the best of it. And we the struggle continued. As far as we were concerned, because we were in prison, it did not mean that we'd stop. So we did everything in that prison to turn it around. And Mandela refers to that in his book, Long Walk to Freedom. He refers to part of it there, save that some parts were excised by some of the Stalinists who edited the book. But he acknowledges that until we arrived, there was a certain accommodation that had happened with prisoners, and our advent changed that. The spirit in the prison changed, and actually the conditions began to change as well. The food improved because we went on hunger strike, not once, many times. And we united the prison on certain issues, whereas until then, the old politicos were stuck with their political formations, and they would hold their separate events and so on. So we insisted on doing these joint activities. So it was a good immersion for us, and also I think for the Mandelas of this world, because they enjoyed our advent. They relished the discussions we had. Very challenging, because Mandela and others could not believe that we had done what we had done. They expected that we would have been supported by certain kinds of institutions. And we said, no, we've done it on our own. And we'd have long arguments about issues, and we'd agree to disagree on things. But that sense of camaraderie developed. And outside prison, it continued with quite a few of us, and particularly with some of my co-accused, because, for instance, Mandela could not do certain things because his comrades would say, we're in prison, so we can't do, make a sort of homemade brew, if you like. But my colleagues would make those, and so Mandela would participate in it. And so he could say to his comrades, look, I'm not making the brew, but somebody else is making it and I'm participating in it. So things like that, would happen in prison.
You've spoken in the past of how psychology was used very much to uphold the apartheid regime. What are the psychological arguments for segregation?
Well, look, a key architect of apartheid was Verwoerd, and he was a psychologist. Indeed, he was...
Former Prime Minister
who was shot once, and then the second time he was knifed to death in Parliament. He was somebody who believed in segregation, but could not adduce any evidence for it. He just felt that the races would get on better if they were kept apart. And it's ironic that his granddaughter actually became one of the ambassadors under President Mandela, where she her views were very different. But for him, the view was you had your own space, you had your own schools, but not looking at the issue of equity or equality. So there were blind sides to it. But his abiding view was there's no place for the black African above the level of certain forms of menial labor. And quoted from the Bible often, that they should be hewers of wood and drawers of water. So he's also on record as saying there's no point in teaching mathematics, because where will they use mathematics? So it was clearly an oppressive system, and military and police might was used to perpetuate that system. So my direct interaction with psychologists was in prison, and particularly in Robben Island prison. One of the heads of the prison was a psychologist. They brought a newer person to deal with political prisoners. And I was assessed, as was Mandela and various others, by psychologists using all sorts of instruments to determine what danger we would be, and whether we would continue our activities on release, and what leadership potential we had, and so on. And those files I've seen more recently. And it's interesting that the psychologists hid the fact that some of them hid the fact that they were psychologists until eventually you confront them and they admit that I am a psychologist. So my position was, look, there's bad uses for any profession, but I saw the immense power of psychology if it can liberate your mind. The biggest oppression is when we allow ourselves to be encapsulated in a place and time that others want us to be restricted to. And if we don't expand our horizons, if our minds are limited, we will be limited. And there's no limitation that ought to be placed on any human being, wherever they are in this world, because anybody can rise to the highest office. Anybody ought to be able to rise to being the best in his or her profession or in his or her work. And it's only certain attitudes and traditions and sometimes oppressive systems that prevent that happening. So for me, psychology is a liberating issue, and that's why I'm engaged in it. I believe that people are better off if they're aware of limitations, and also if you're aware of certain symptoms. If we, for instance, were to teach our kids early on in primary school about stress, about issues of depression and so on, they'd be able to recognize it quicker. And those factors, stress and depression, for instance, are bigger issues now. The World Health Organization has been warning about it for years. Depression is one of the biggest problems we confront. But we don't need to experience depression if we're aware of the symptoms and we take other measures to counteract them. So in the schools, we need a decent dose of psychological education to help our kids cope better. And we're now having it in the full thrust of the technological revolution. Some say it's the second or third industrial revolution, but it's after the agrarian and industrial revolutions, it's a technological revolution. So countries, and especially places like KL, have utilized technology to its fullest right now. But our kids are participating in it, but their potential is not being realized fully. So through psychological education, through processes that psychological knowledge can bring, we can create better citizens. The kinds of incidents that we have, where teenagers self-destruct, where you have a fire in a boarding school and kids are killed, ought not to happen, because we ought to be able to predict some of these things. And that's where psychology becomes utterly useful. So there's beneficial uses, and there's no area of human endeavor that does not rely on psychology. Where there are people, you have to have human interaction, you have to have behaviors that will make us relate to each other, and we live in a world that is totally multicultural. It's multilingual, it's multi-religious, and the sooner we come to understand that that is what it is, the better we'll be. We'll get on with doing our stuff outside of narrow religious mendicants limiting us, outside of narrow politicians trying to herd us in certain directions. People's potential is out there. The will to be free, to liberate ourselves, and to achieve fully is in the human spirit. And that spirit cannot be imprisoned anyway.
Maybe I'll end with this last question. You've said that psychology's last frontier is in Africa. Can I get you to expand on that?
Well, look, all the research tells us that 94-95% of the world's population can trace their DNA to the oldest living ethnic group in the world, the Komani San of of the southern Kalahari, bordering Namibia, Botswana, and parts of northwestern South Africa. So people moved over time. And Africa did not have the borders it had until the 1830s, when the colonial powers got together and decided on certain things and imposed certain borders. Africa is rich with natural and other resources, which over, say, 150 or so years has been totally pillaged. And European countries have gotten rich through that, as they have done through colonization in parts of Asia. Psychology, though, is not regarded very highly in most of Africa, because many of the rulers feel, well, you can't eat psychology. What is its utilitarian value? So they falsely believe that you may as well do economics. But if you do economics, what entrepreneurship are you creating? You actually need to be able to develop the individual. And no science develops the individual as does education that's underpinned by psychological knowledge. So in the continent, we are involved in a quest to ensure that psychological teachings and psychological knowledge is brought to bear for development locally, at a national level and regionally, because it's only through that kind of interstice with science and with education and with the discipline that you can get a more endowed citizen. And that citizen does not become dependent on somebody else. That citizen becomes more independent, able to create and able to get on with life. And so we're involved in a quest to ensure that psychology exists and thrives. And if you look at the nexus between human development and wealth, you'll find that those countries where there's high wealth and security, psychological knowledge prevails. It's used, it's not in your face, but it's used all the time. And so that's the lesson we're taking to large parts of Latin America, Asia, and Africa, that we need to integrate psychology into all that we do. There isn't an area of human development that does not need that kind of psychoeducation and underpinning.
Professor Seth Cooper, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.